This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. I am so happy today to welcome an author who, well, she was meant for me because she writes the kind of books that I love. And I had programmed it back in 2015 when she wrote her wonderful, wonderful best-selling book, When Books Went to War, she would have been on the program, but I started in 2015, and I am known as America's red-hot book lover. So I am so happy to welcome another book lover, Molly Guptill-Manning. Hi, Molly.
Hi, how are you?
Wow, Molly, you are like my dream writer.
Oh.
Not only do you have the subject that I love to talk about, books, but you do this wonderful research and keep all of this alive, keep bringing back. People have forgotten so much. And the new book is called The War of Words, How America's GI Journalists Battle Censorship and Propaganda to Help Win World War II. Now, for me, Molly, this is a very, very important book because I happen to know where my dad was 79 years ago today.
Oh,
not many people
where
do.
Where was he?
He was in the Battle of the Bulge.
Oh, well, I have a chapter about the Battle of the Bulge in the War of Words.
I know. And that's why I tell you, when I read that chapter, I got very emotional because for me, my dad was just the most wonderful person in the world, and he was so good to me. Mm-hmm. And 79 years ago today, he was 3 days into the Battle of Bulge. And it was about now that his feet started to freeze. And for the next 1 month, 1 week, and 5 days, as he marched through the forest, and suffered, I'm sure that at some point he probably read a newspaper that you've now looked at, because most people don't know about the journalists who were writing at that time.
No, and you know, it's like your father's experience. The newspapers didn't always have breaking news about things that were going on around the world. Sometimes they were just validating the experiences of the troops that were right there. And so the fact that their feet were freezing cold, and that they would read the newspapers, and then newspapers were one of the most wonderful sources of insulation. So they would often wrap their feet in the newspapers after they were done reading because it would help them stay warmer. But they would validate their experiences. They wrote poems about the heartbreak and the fear and even just the cold. And so these were sources of information, but also validation.
So explain how this happened, because, of course, there were the official newspapers and everybody saw those. But you've really just jumped deeply into this research to discover the small newspapers, the newspapers written by the guys actually out there.
Right.
How did that come about? What, first of all, the inspiration for the book, and then what you discovered.
Well, after When Books Went to War was published, I received an email from a World War II veteran who said that they did read books, but one of the most precious things was also their troop newspapers. And so he told me about his unit's newspaper. It was a small newspaper, but it told their stories, and he kept them all. He had a whole collection of these newspapers from, you know, about 70 years ago at that point. And he said, you know, that's something that we all treasured. And I had no idea that those existed, even though I had researched World War II for such a long time. And so I did some digging to find out how ubiquitous these newspapers were. And it turned out they were everywhere. And I found out there was over 4,600 different newspapers because every unit printed their own. And I started to find some of these newspapers, and I realized these were the heart and soul of the unit. These captured what the experience was for the people who had their boots on the ground, who weren't doing necessarily glamorous work, but they were helping win the war. And so the more I read these things, the more I developed like a personal connection to them, because it's impossible if you find a unit newspaper and then you read a few of them to not feel a connection to the people that you're reading about. They're very, very personal newspapers. And I realize no one seems to know much about these newspapers, and they're really important because, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if you looked up your father's unit or division. You could probably find some newspapers and his name might be in them. And then all of a sudden you have this long lost story about your father from 80 years ago. So these are really important pieces of history. And I think people should know about them.
Well, I do too. It's really so amazing, this fact, because when the guys came back, so many of them never talked about the war. My dad never talked about it until really at the end of his life, when I was finally, you know, really pushing him to get as much information as I could. Because when I was a child, I mean, we knew he was at war. He had a box filled with some things we'd peek into. It was in the attic. And we didn't understand the impact of it. We saw the medals. We saw that he had a Silver Star, but it never even occurred to us to ask him because he never talked about it. The only thing he ever talked about was the Battle of the Bulge and that Marlene Dietrich stopped on the side of the road where he was walking down the side of the road with his troop. There were only eight guys. They were on their way to the camp where she was going to be singing. She drove past. They saw, you know, a Jeep go past. The Jeep stopped, and she stood up, and she pulled off her helmet, and her beautiful hair flowed out. And from that moment on, he was in love with her. And every time a black and white movie came on television with her, and the whole family had to sit there and watch it because he was in love with her. You know, my mom didn't mind, you know, because... Yeah. That was a memory. That was the only beautiful memory that he had of the war. Just seeing her gorgeous hair flowing out, you know, because she was one of the few entertainers that went right to the front. She was there, and she was so brave, and the men loved her, and that she stopped her Jeep. She didn't have to. She was, you know, she had a time that she was supposed to be singing to a lot of guys, but she stopped for that one little bunch of guys on the side of the road. Aww. And so things like that are so important to remember. And what you're doing here to preserve these stories, I think it's like a gift from God, I think, to so many people, because it is important. We have to understand. There was so much censorship in, you know, the periodicals and the civilian papers and the military magazines. But these are the true stories.
These are the true stories. And, you know, sometimes there would be censorship, so the troops just wouldn't mail these newspapers until they got the okay from the censor. So in some ways, these newspapers capture information that weren't captured anywhere else. Which is incredible. And something else that's kind of interesting about the newspapers and also the books that troops read is that just like your father's experience with Marlene Dietrich, the newspapers and the books, these were also a positive thing that came out of the war. And so I have found that when I would interview World War II veterans to talk about the war, they never wanted to talk about battles, and I didn't really need to ask about them because I was interested in what they read and what they wrote. And that was something that they'd light up and they'd want to talk about that. And so it's interesting how the overall experience seemed to be to want to leave behind the combat and the danger and the death and all of those negative elements. But if you could find something about the war that was a bit more positive, something that was good that came out of it, I find that troops are more willing to talk about it.
Well, the fact that the guys were willing, there were guys willing to carry typewriters into war and to come out with a way to create ink when they ran out of ink. It's the stories are beautiful. So tell us some of those things that you discovered.
Sure. If you ever come across a 1940s typewriter and try to pick it up, you will be amazed by how heavy it is. They were pretty much solid metal. And so the fact that, as you said, troops would carry these truce papers into battle anywhere that they went because it was so important for them to record what was happening, it's extraordinary. But being at the front, they ran out of supplies, and they usually had to scrounge around and find replacements. And so there is a story about a unit that ran out of ink, but they had paper and they had a mimeograph machine because the War Department would give them a mimeograph machine to print on. They had their typewriters, which the War Department also provided, but they had no ink. And so they mixed shoe polish with insect repellent and made their own ink. They would scrounge around for paper. If they didn't have paper, they would try to find some local business that used paper, and they would try to create some kind of arrangement so they could do a trade or a swap or just purchase paper. Sometimes they would find whole printing plants. And so sometimes they would agree to fix the equipment if it was damaged or do different things that would help out the printer in exchange for being allowed to use their printing machine to have a newspaper before they moved out of town. So they were really always trying to find ways to print because it was just so important to them. But they had a lot of difficulties trying to print under war conditions, and yet they always seem to find a way to get around it.
Well, and what comes through, I love some of the humor, you know, even in the midst of what they were going through. And what sort of, we just had the 82nd anniversary of Pearl Harbor, and now this month is the 79th anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge. And when you think of it, it started on December 16th, which, you know, is not a great time in Europe. And particularly that year was a particularly cold one. And the guys were so cold. That's the only thing I knew for sure about my father. For most people, when you had Father's Day when I was a kid, fathers would get ties. Everyone would give their father a tie. But we always gave our father socks, the most expensive, the best socks we could, because his feet were still hurting from the Battle of the Bulge. And so that was his gift for Father's Day, Christmas, any holiday when we had to wanted to give him a gift. It was socks, because he really appreciated that. And so many people, you know, it's so hard to believe that we are having, there's a war in Europe again, there's a war here, there's a war there. And at that time, you know, back in the 40s, we're at war, two sides of the world, the Pacific side and, of course, the European side. And how terrible that particular battle was, because when we went into that battle, most people don't know that America had only 228,000 soldiers, and the Germans were already up to over 400,000, and we were facing terrible odds, and that our guys could still find a sense of humor in even naming their newspapers. Tell us some of the names that they came out with.
In Europe, they had some of the most, you know, sarcastic and kind of bitter titles possible, but there was the Scars and Grapes, the Sarryburg Gazette, the Latrinogram.
You know, that's a good one.
Humor. Yeah, but it was just a way to show their personality. You know, these were civilian soldiers, and they had senses of humor, and the military's regimentation and discipline was difficult for them to adjust to. So anytime they could assert their selfhood and kind of get out from underneath all of the discipline and seriousness of it, it made them feel like themselves. And so these newspapers also represent that. There's a lot of cartoons that came out of these, a lot of jokes. Even classified ads were made funny. There was one that was printed overseas, and the classified just read, "Wanted, a ride home." You know, they just want to get back home.
The stories you've discovered and the information that you've, you know, with all this wonderful research, isn't research fun? People don't understand how much fun research is.
It really is, because like I said, when I would find a whole slew of newspapers by the same unit, I would just become so invested reading their stories and learning who the different people were, that by the time I got to the last one, I'd actually feel sad because there were no more updates about what was going on with them or what happened to them in their lives.
This is fantastic research. That's the kind of research that you where you just get lost and you're having so much fun in the research. One of the things, mm-hmm. stories I have to mention, and I thought it was so, I never thought of this one, the Women's Army Corps. And what was said about them, because there were so many wonderful movies being made about women in war, beautiful movies, you know, always with nurses, and I couldn't believe the rumors that were being spread about the Army's G.I. Janes.
Well, I think for the nurses, they somehow went into another category. I think the nurses had great respect, and part of the thing for that is just that when troops were injured, there was this anecdote that comes up in just about every book I've read that describes this scene, but troops wouldn't yell for medics, they'd yell for their mothers. And so I think when they had a female nurse tending to them, it was almost like having their mom. So I think for the nurses, they kind of escaped this kind of rumor, but for almost everyone else, there was this horrible rumor that spread at home that the women who volunteered were really just prostitutes, and that the War Department came up with a super secret agreement with Washington to have women come into uniform so that they could basically just be prostitutes for the male troops. And when that rumor spread, and it went all around the country because it was a syndicated newspaper column, so it was just everywhere, the women started to be really abused. And horrible things were said about them. There were people who were serving in World War II, and then their wives joined, you know, as in the Women's Army Corps. And they would get divorced over this because they would think that it was basically the same as their wife announcing, "I'm going to be a prostitute now." And so it was really awful. And the truth was that women were never, they were not prostitutes. And they were actually doing a lot of really important work. Dwight Eisenhower said that he felt that the women on his staff were doing twice the work that the men were doing, and he wanted more women on staff because they were just doing such outstanding, high-quality, and efficient work. So there was kind of two sides to the whole thing, but I don't think most history books acknowledge the fact that women faced so much adversity, not just because they were trailblazers and they were the first women to volunteer for military service and wear an actual uniform, but because of this horrible rumor that spread and most people believing that they were just prostitutes and not actually serious military personnel.
Well, you know, all of the stories in the book are just fascinating. I love the one where you that in the Pacific War, where someone printed a nice phrase that it sticks in your mind, land on the sand with the general and the band. So, so nothing changes. We still have, we have military leaders who want glory. And so I thought that was rather funny.
Yeah, there's a song called "Don't Fence Me In, and they refashioned the lyrics to Don't Send Me In. And it's quite a funny rendition of the song, but yeah, he says, please let me land on the sand with the general and the band. Don't send me in.
Yeah, exactly.
And he just wants to, you know, the amphibious landings of the Pacific were deadly. Everybody knew it. It was basically like advancing in front of a firing squad because a lot of islands only had one point of entry. And so the Japanese knew exactly where the Allies were going to land. And the, you know, the troops hated these. And so by creating this funny song, they could at least let off a little steam, acknowledge they all felt that way. And it kind of gave them a sense of catharsis.
I think so. After this, we're going to have a commercial in a minute, and we're going to talk about little books. And my father was issued one little, an official little book, when he was sent from Europe home, and he thought he was going, based in America after being sent from Europe. And then as he arrived in New York, they gave him this little book, and it was, he looked at it and he said, oh boy, that's the worst book I ever saw in my life. And it was a Japanese phrase book.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So because, you know, the war in the Pacific was not over, and that's what they planned to send him there. So, yeah, so we'll get to the little books. But I do want to mention also that a part of the books, the magazines and the, you know, newspapers that the guys wrote, some were very serious. And I particularly think the one about the 42nd Division's account of liberation of Dhaka. Wow, yeah. That's strong.
It is. I mean, it's heartbreaking to read some of the things that they wrote. They felt very strongly because they were the ones that were liberating the camp. They wanted to be able to say what it was like to do that, and they wanted to be able to record what it looked like, because they didn't want civilian correspondents coming in days and weeks later, once conditions had improved, and describe it in a less horrific state. They wanted people to know just how horrific it was. There's a very long quote of it, because their words it shouldn't be paraphrased in my mind.
No.
You know, their words should sing and be the ones to continue to tell that story.
Yeah, that's why I think this book is so important. The War of Words is the book that we're talking about right now. We're going to have a little commercial break, and when I come back, we're going to then talk about your other book, When Books Went to War, because they tie in together. Okay, so you hold on, and I'm going to have a little book buzz. That's the promo for our Christmas book. And then after the commercials, we'll be right back. Okay?
Sounds good.
Okay.
Hey everyone, it's Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Tock Clock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. The holidays are here, so do expect Santa Claus to show up at your house, sliding down your chimney with gifts he has in store for you. But the question is, how does Santa go down the chimney? And what if you don't even have one? These are the questions asked in the book titled, How Does Santa Go Down the Chimney? The book was written by Mac Barnett and illustrated by John Clausen. How Does Santa Go Down the Chimney asks delightful questions about how the big man in red is able to deliver gifts. How does Santa get in the chimney? Does he get stuck? What happens if there is no chimney, and what does he do then? These are all questions that we wonder at times, and they're asked in such a delightful way that continues to enhance the curiosity of the reader. The author and illustrator duo found that kids don't usually care so much about answers, so instead of answers, the author and illustrator came up with theories to the question. For the illustrator, he tried to draw the story with a bit of an edge, considering that Santa creeping into one's house in the middle of the night is not just a tad bit scary. While the idea of Santa creeping into one's house might seem a little scary, the story wipes those thoughts away in a delightful read aloud that makes it seem that it might be harder for Santa to get in than we might have thought. How do you think Santa goes down the chimney? This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with the Z, and I am back with my very special guest today, Molly Guptill Manning, and we are talking about her wonderful books, and we just finished talking about The War of Words, which ties in with her first book about books, which is called When Books Went to War, and it was published back in December of 2014, which was a few months before I started Joy on Paper in 2015. But I wish I had the program then, because she would have been on, because When Books Went to War is a story that helped us win World War II. Hi, Molly.
Hi.
Okay, well, we're back, and I must say that I'm as thrilled with When Books Went to War as I am with The War of Words, because you are preserving stories that people had forgotten, and this is such a wonderful thing to do.
Yes, I mean, I love this. I love both books, but they're both, you know, products of finding stories that are unknown. And I just discovered both of them in an archive. Well, The War of Words through archives and World War II veterans, but you know, it's how words really sustained troops during World War II. And when it came to books, nothing provided a better distraction from the horrors of war than getting lost in a story. It allowed their minds to wander far from battlefields. And, you know, if they were reading a book about the United States, it was like going on a visit home for a little bit. And so books were incredibly important during World War II. Of course, they were also banned by the Nazis across Europe, anywhere that the German army was, there were book bans. And so what's incredible is that at a time when books were being restricted, the American military decided to give troops books, and they literally invaded Europe with a lot of titles that were banned and that had been burned there. So it's just an incredible story.
Well, again, just coming upon, it's so wonderful for an author when you stumble onto something and you get that spark. Oh my goodness, did anyone write a book about this yet? you want to jump in there and get it out, and you certainly did with this one. So, you know, as you said, it was so important because for our guys, they are so far from home. They are not getting much news, unless, as you said, they created it themselves, or they read, you know, the approved newspapers from the army. But to get the books from home, which today is paralleled in one of the things I promoted, paperbacks for to send to the troops. So tell us about when this started and how who started it, because of course it comes back to people who love books, because it tell us about the librarians.
So, you know, in the 1930s, Germany started book burnings and they started banning titles and then the complete works of authors. And it was just an awful time. And American librarians were watching this happen and just thought, there's no way this will ever happen in the United States. You know, we will do something if it ever were to come to that. And then after the attack on Pearl Harbor, all of a sudden it seemed like, well, maybe such a thing could get closer to happening, because now the United States is actually in the war. And so American librarians decided they needed to do something to ensure that books would be safeguarded. And one thing that they decided to do was meet the Army's morale crisis, because the Army was trying to get as many people in uniform as possible, but they didn't have housing and uniforms and supplies for all the people they were drafting. And so morale plummeted. And so American librarians thought, well, we can fight book bans by bringing books together, not to burn and not to ban, but to read, by having the biggest book drive in American history, and then we can give all these books to troops. So then troops will have some form of entertainment. They'll get some kind of escape from the military when they had off-duty hours. And it would really be doing two incredible things at once. And so that's what they did. They launched the Victory Book Campaign in 1942 and 1943. They raised over 18 million books. And they all were donated to the military.
And of course, for our guys, getting these books was so important. When you're there and you had nothing to do but wait, often wait to get, you know, killed, you needed this connection back home.
Yes. So that's the thing. Books really were a connection to home. They made people, I mean, whether the story made them remember home or it was just holding something, even just in English, because a lot of troops were stationed in areas of the world where English was not the first language. They couldn't understand anything that was around them if they didn't speak whatever language it was. And so to get something just in English made them feel a bit more like at home. And so books played so many important roles in kind of just providing comfort and escape to troops. And, you know, the Victory Book Campaign, because of the nature of the American publishing industry at the time, which was to print only hardcover books, the Victory Book Campaign did a great job raising books, but publishers really came under some pressure from the Army to produce best-selling books in paperback format, because troops that were in combat could not carry heavy hardcovers, but they desperately wanted to read. And so with that pressure, the military was able to get into an agreement with the top publishers of the United States to print these miniature books called Armed Services Editions. They were sized to fit the hip or breast pocket of a military uniform. And so now all of a sudden troops could carry books anywhere that they went. And it was as easy as slipping it in and out of a pocket when they wanted to read or when they had to put it away. And it was just the most popular, incredible program of the war.
And they published 120 million of these small and lightweight books.
Exactly. And so every month they'd publish a new batch of titles. It started out with 30 titles a month. At the height of the program, it was 42 different titles a month. And they would wrap them up in these little packages. They were like smaller than a shoebox when they were all put together. And they were mailed and airdropped and sometimes dropped by parachute onto American positions so that books reached troops no matter where they were in the world. And every month a fresh batch would come.
Oh, it's beautiful. I love that you mentioned that they rescued The Great Gatsby because mm-hmm. it became such a popular book.
Right. The Great Gatsby was printed as an armed services edition at the height of the program. So 155,000 copies of The Great Gatsby were printed and sent overseas. And now when F. Scott Fitzgerald died in the 1920s, The Great Gatsby was considered to be a complete failure. In fact, the last royalties he earned from the book were based on copies of the book he purchased himself. And so it just, the critics hated it. The public didn't buy it. It was just kind of a disaster for Fitzgerald. But then fast forward into World War II, 155,000 copies of it were printed as armed services editions. And all of a sudden, people started talking about The Great Gatsby. Troops would write home saying, I'm reading this book called The Great Gatsby, and I'm enjoying it.
The story itself is so fascinating because you know, when you think about it, and The Great Gatsby has had an amazing effect on you know, the sort of the world, starting with the 50s when, you know, people were reading it and they made movies. And thinking about the guys, you know, in the jungle, in the Battle of the Bulge, reading about Gatsby and imagining this beautiful life, you know, this house, this the clothes and all of this. I think it's so mind-boggling when you think of it, and it's so wonderful mm-hmm. that they did this. But it wasn't just The Great Gatsby. I love this story, particularly, I think, the one about Betty Smith. So we have time for that one. So can you tell us about Betty Smith and the book that she wrote and why it became so popular?
Yeah. So Betty Smith wrote a book called A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. And it's hard to measure how popular an armed services edition was because troops didn't buy them. They were just given them for free. And so the way that I measure the popularity of specific titles that were printed as armed services editions is by the number of letters that an author received from troops about the book. Betty Smith received over 10,000 letters from troops during World War II who read her book, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. It was an absolute sensation. It was so popular that it was printed as an armed services edition. It was actually circulated to troops on the eve of the invasion of Normandy, but troops around the world got it also, that they had to reprint the book as an armed services edition. So there's two editions of the book. But troops loved the way that she wrote about, I think, just growing up. They related to this story on a very personal level. And it's interesting because the main character is a young girl, and here you have an army of young boys and young men reading about this young girl getting raised in Brooklyn, and it just resonated with them very, very deeply. And so there are letters from troops overseas talking about how the book basically saved their lives because, I guess I'll turn to the story that's in the introduction of When Books Went to War, but there's a story from a Marine, and he's about 20 years old, and he talks about how he had been in combat for 2 years already, and he felt that his heart was dead. He watched a friend of his die, and that experience made him feel unable to feel anything. And so he said that he walked around with a dead heart, and he was hospitalized with malaria, and a nurse gave him a copy of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, because there's nothing else to do when you're in the hospital but to read. And so he started reading the book, and it made him feel again. And he wrote a letter to Betty Smith telling her how it made him laugh and it made him cry. And he said that he was so proud of those tears because it proved he was human. He didn't think he was human anymore after what the war put him through. But the fact that he could read a book that made him laugh and cry proved to him that he was alive. Oh, and he ends the letter to her saying, I couldn't sleep through this night unless I wrote a letter to the woman who caused me to live again.
That's such a beautiful story. And it brought tears to my eyes because one of the things I was thinking about, my dad was waiting there for the landing of at Normandy. I like to think that perhaps he was reading that book because, you know, when he landed in Normandy, all hell broke out and there was nothing beautiful happening, but that he had that idea, the memory of a tree grows in Brooklyn in his head. It gave me some comfort to think about that. And I think for so many people, we have so many people who have fathers or grandfathers, uncles and relatives and aunts who served in the war. I think these stories are important. And I'm sure that it would be just a wonderful gift to give to people. If you have anybody in your family who's was involved in World War II, who remembers it, and who just wants to know more about the military and how war affects them, I want to highly recommend The War of Words, which is a brilliantly researched book. It is so wonderful. Molly Guptill Manning, you are an amazing author. I'm just thrilled with both of your books, and I hope that people will get this book and they'll enjoy it for themselves and also give it as a gift, because I think it's an important book that for people to read.
I agree. I think if you're curious about anything about World War II, and if you had a relative or friend or family member who happened to serve, I wrote both books with an eye to making them accessible, whether you know anything about World War II or not. I think both books can make you laugh and cry. They are just these very personalized accounts of what it was like to go to war. And it shows you a side of war that you probably never heard about before.
Exactly. And I think, you know, in our current situation in life, that we're facing so many, many problems in the world, and we're thinking about the military, both of the books are great. And The War of Words, How America's GI Journalists Battle Censorship and Propaganda to Help Win World War II is a wonderful book, Molly. Thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. And I just want to say that, you know, one of the things that the book, by the way, is available, of course, wherever books are sold. I hope it's sold in bookstores, and I hope that one of the things that you will do is you know, have this opportunity now to promote the book during the holiday season, and then when you have time, if you would come back and we can talk about your first book, which is called The Myth of Ephraim Tutt, Arthur Train and His Great Literary Hoax. And I think I'll have a special program about literary hoaxes. So will you come back?
Oh, yes, I'd love to. It's a fabulous book. So
it is a fabulous book. As I said, again, it was released a few years before I started the program. I'm heading into a big anniversary in March. I started my program March 17th, 2015. But we're going to have you back sometime soon, and we'll talk about your other book, okay?
That sounds great. Well, thanks so much for having me today.
Okay. Bye-bye now, Molly. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. All right. That is, what a book. Well, two books. Both books are wonderful. Really wonderful. If you want to look around for a gift, this is a great gift. Now, I want to play a very special promo for a very special author.
A Christmas Poem by J.S. Lamb. Ornaments on a tree, Hallmark movies on TV, reindeers playing hide and seek, Frosty trying not to peek. And what on my face appears? Mild wild smiles and salty tears.
Wow. Oh, I love that poem. And I am so thrilled that Jim Lamb has been such a great friend to Joy on Paper. And one of the things that he's been doing over the past years, ever since he started listening to Joy on Paper, he's one of my first fans, and I have to thank him so much. But we just did a big promo, and he did a press release for the books that we recommend for gifts this year. And you can go to my website, radio-joyonpaper.com, and you can see the books that we recommend there. And they are recommended by my three Book Buzz special correspondents, Rita Moreau, Bria Burton, and Devon Miller. And they have had so much fun both doing the book buzzes for authors, because one of the things that happens, and this is something that happens for all authors, books come out and then, well, the river of Amazon is big and wide, and sometimes they just keep flowing down there, but nobody picks them up. Because there are a lot of books out there, but we want to always remind people of the books that we love and the books that shouldn't be forgotten. So you can go to my website, and on Thursday I'm going to be talking more about them. And one of the important, you know, I want to mention one particular book that is very important to me, because I just love Nat Geo. And National Geographic has been so good to Joy on Paper. In every November, I make National Geographic Month because I want people to get National Geographic books. And this month, you know, when we're talking about books for Christmas and books for the holidays, you cannot get a better book than a National Geographic book. So please, check out National Geographic online and check out my website, again, radio-joyonpaper, because I have a lot of recommendations for National Geographic books that are wonderful. Why I like National Geographic books for holidays is that I turn them into the type of thing that you did at school, yearbooks, and have people actually sign in the back of the books and the front of the books and leave messages, because over the years, as you bring that book out every year for a holiday event, and families can see how things change, particularly if you've had a child write in somebody's book, and that's the only time that you can let a child write in a book, is write their name in a book, you know, and then years later, you go back to that book and you see a very simple message like, I love you, Granddad, or something like that. And it just fills your heart with joy. So you can turn a Nat Geo book into a yearbook, a treasure for your family. And it will be a book that you will hand down through generations, because it has something very personal, a very personal message, a yearbook. I know so many people who still have their yearbooks. They moved from city to city over the years, sometimes 30 years, sometimes 40 years. And the funny thing is, you'll look over on their bookcase and there'll be their yearbook, because they keep those messages. They want that connection. And that's what the Nat Geo yearbook idea comes from. So do get a Nat Geo book and give it to somebody and say, turn it into a yearbook and turn it into a memory that you will treasure and always love. And so I just wanted to say that again. And again, thank you very much to Jim Lamb for his wonderful, wonderful Christmas poem. I have made a video of that, and I'm going to put that on my website today too. So you can see it. It's already on my Facebook page, which you can go to, and that's Radio Joy on Paper. And you can see the video I have made for the Christmas poem. Again, it was a wonderful, just a wonderful and fun thing for me to do when I got his book of poetry. It's called Herding Butterflies, and his book is available on Amazon in both Kindle and paperback version, and it is wonderful. It's a beautifully illustrated book because not only is are his poems beautiful, and it's an eclectic assortment of poetry, but he is a wonderful artist, and so the book is illustrated, a wonderful gift book for people. Particularly, this is a great book to give anybody who wants to be a writer, because Jim Lamb is able to tell a story using very few words. It's amazing, and it's something when you're reading his book and you say, how can he tell a story in 20 lines? How can he just paint a picture for you? And his stories and his poetry are so really so heartwarming, often funny, and sometimes very serious subjects, but he uses words in a beautiful way, and that's what writing is about. So for all of you who are thinking about making a New Year's resolution to write a book, well, you should get Herding Butterflies by Jim Lamb. Okay, I want to play out here a song for my dad, as I love to do, because, as I said, it's a Battle of the Bulge, 79 years ago today, and we're going to play the Army song. And everybody, bye-bye now, and on Thursday I have a special program. We'll be talking more about the books you should read.